in relationship to the dominoes, the Middle Eastern dominoes?
Well, there's some scheduled demonstration somewhere tomorrow, and now I'm lapsing on where in the Arab world it is.
Well, there has been a demonstration in Jordan on every Friday for quite a few weeks, and you can read that. You can read about that through an article about that through the antiwar.com website.
Okay, that's a wrap. Opinions of those speakers, labor hours, itching to go. Thanks for listening.
Hello, folks. Welcome to the February 19th, 2011 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air by WFT 90.1 FM radio in Champaign, Illinois, and webcast live worldwide at weft.org. The views and opinions expressed in this hour program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WFT's management or board of directors or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Tom to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is being brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. I'm your host, David Johnson, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us. And later in the show, the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's poem for this week from his collection, Cries for Justice, will be Close the Plantation Down. And also here with us today is Bob Pelesny, our other co-host and technical advisor, special guest John and fellow worker John Fitton, co-host Jason Kozlowski, and co-host and founder of the Illinois World Labor Hour, Bill Gorell. Now here's Tom to kick off this week's edition of Workers' Interest News.
Our neighbors to the north in Wisconsin are doing what the populations of all 50 states should be doing. Thousands of citizens, from teachers to prison guards to students, descended on the capital of Madison on Wednesday to try to preserve the union rights of public employees in the state that was the first to grant collective bargaining to government workers over 50 years ago. The new Republican governor, Scott Walker, is seeking passage of the nation's most aggressive anti-union proposal, a plan that would all but eliminate the bargaining process for most public employees. The sweeping measure was moving swiftly through the GOP-nominated legislature and would mark a dramatic shift for Wisconsin, which passed a comprehensive collective bargaining law in 1959 and was the birthplace of the National Union representing all non-federal public employees. The State House filled with as many as 10,000 demonstrators, and many Madison teachers joined the protest by calling in sick in such numbers that the district had to cancel classes. As protesters chanted outside his office door on the second consecutive day of demonstration, Governor Walker insisted he has the votes to pass the measure. However, if the measure does pass, many fear it will signal a deep, if not fatal, bite to the rights of all workers nationwide and will only be the beginning of the end of justice in the workplaces of America.
Yes, Tom. One of the major and generally little publicized factors that forced Egypt's former president Hosni Mubarak out of office was the wave of strikes that erupted throughout the country. Workers in industry, banking, agriculture, and the stock exchange stopped work, and most remain on strike this week. With less than 25% of the labor force unionized, a high proportion of workers in the public sector, and the official labor federation little more than a conveyor belt for the regime, such massive mobilization by workers was completely unexpected, certainly by those in power. In recent years, workers from Mahalla have developed a reputation for defying both the government and the official union movement, and they have provided the trigger for what became the rebellion of January 25th. The April 6th movement, which took the most prominent role in organizing the events in Cairo's Tahrir Square, took its name from a strike in 2008 by workers in Mahalla. And the workers at Egypt's larger factory still remain on strike, an independent labor group said on Saturday, in defiance of warnings by the ruling military junta that it will no longer tolerate protests. Around 15,000 workers from the Mizr Spinning and Weaving, which employs 24,000 people in the Nile Delta city of Mahalla, are holding a sit-in for the fourth day in front of the administration building, the Center for Trade Union and Workers Services said in a statement. The workers have refused to end their protest until their principal demand is met, and that is to remove the head of the company, Fouad Abdel Alim, who is accused of corruption, it said. Dave?
Hey, I don't have a real news story here, but I would like to wish Damian Matthew, one of our fellow workers, who's now working for the SEIU in Ohio, a happy birthday. And I'd also like to wish Dan Chambers, who's now working for the Maryland Education Association, a happy birthday.
Yes, two very good fellow workers. And the Maryland Education Association, of course, is affiliated with the National Education Association Teachers Union. Okay, this is a news story from our friend Harry Kelber in New York City. In the high-stakes poker game with the Republicans, President Obama has opened the betting on the federal budget and deficit reduction with a $3.7 trillion bundle of chips. Using the tax money we've paid the government, Obama has decided to cut or eliminate 200 federal programs, many devoted to social services and education, to serve the nation's middle class and the working poor. At the same time, he has chosen to boost military spending as well as funding for the construction of nuclear power plants. The president repeated his proposal to freeze discretionary domestic spending for 5 years, and of course the salaries and perks we pay him and his staff will remain intact. But despite his proposed $3.75 trillion deficit cutting plan, Obama admits he can't compete against House Republicans in depriving Americans of the comforts and conveniences that we have become accustomed to. He plans to up the ante when he gets into secret bargaining with GOP Republican leaders and reach an acceptable, quote-unquote, compromise. Here is a short list of critical government services the Republicans want to take away from us and without asking our permission. One, they want to slash education from Head Start programs to Pell Grant scholarships for college applicants. They want to cut investments in infrastructure, slash the subsidies for the home energy needs of poor people, cut the money to send out Social Security checks, cut food safety and environmental inspections, and eliminate an enormous number of middle-class jobs. Those three national programs have been the economic and health lifelines for tens of millions of people from the time they were founded decades ago. For the Republicans in Congress to do anything to weaken their effectiveness would throw the country and its population into chaos. That is why we cannot allow wealthy legislators who eat well, live well, and are paid well to make the life and death decisions that affect all of us. We, the people, need to be the third party at the bargaining table when these issues, when the issues about what to do about the budget deficits are decided.
According to the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, some companies are weeding out job applicants just because they're unemployed. After news accounts about the practice and requests from concerned lawmakers, the EEOC has jumped in trying to determine whether it's a widespread tactic that could be violating federal job discrimination laws. Commissioners at an EEOC hearing last week are investigating whether the exclusions of the job list may have a greater effect on blacks, Latinos, and other ethnic minorities who tend to suffer from higher jobless rates. Unfortunately, there are no specific protections for the unemployed. According to William Spriggs, Assistant Secretary for Policy at the Labor Department, the potential for disparity is there. Overall, unemployment is over 9%, with nearly 14 million people out of work. However, the jobless rate amongst blacks is 15.7%, and amongst Hispanics, 11.9%. These figures come from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. Spriggs said the chances of an employer considering an ethnic minority are decreased at least a third if jobless applicants are excluded from possible hiring. Also, the pool of disabled applicants could be reduced by some 50%. Spriggs said it would be difficult for the government to measure the problem because most job openings are not posted publicly, and he said government officials are concerned the practice could hamper the government's efforts to help the unemployed get back to work.
Yeah, I'd like to remind any conservative people who may be listening who sit here and sit there, and generally you're probably born on second or third base anyway. And, you know, just to remember that whenever you're criticizing the long-term unemployed, especially the 99ers, they are specifically being discriminated against because they are unemployed. And it really just makes me sick. And I've been running into this, and I got in a big argument with a local person here on Facebook over this, and it's just ridiculous to blame these victims. That just shows that one of the basic character traits of conservative people is a complete lack of empathy and inability to sympathize with their fellow human beings, except for some reason, billionaires. Anything that happens to a billionaire, oh boy, they're sad about that. And guess what? It's more than likely you're not going to be a billionaire. So don't worry about the taxes that billionaires pay, because you're probably going to be a little piddly nothing anyway.
Excellent, Bill.
Bill, why don't you tell us how you really feel now? Come on. Don't hold back. Bob, you got another news story?
Yeah, I'm going to recap some statistics here. And most of this, again, comes from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And it's been reported on here over the last month, but I think it's important this week to kind of mention this again, that the number of American workers in unions declined sharply last year, the Bureau of Labor Statistics reported, with the percentage slipping to 11.9%, the lowest rate in more than 70 years. The report found that the number of workers in unions fell by 612,000 last year to 14.7 million. The number of private sector workers in unions fell by 339,000 to 7.1 million, while the number in public sector union members fell to 7.6 million. And also, work stoppages last year were the second lowest on record, the Department of Labor announced last Tuesday. Despite a few high-profile disputes, there are only 11 major strikes and lockouts involving more than 1,000 workers in 2010. And that announcement came just weeks after the Labor Department said that the total unionization rate had fallen last year. Lockouts and strikes have been declining in recent decades. Last year, there were only 17 work stoppages compared to 269 from 1970 to 1981.
Okay, and another kind of related story. John Fitton has brought us in some really interesting information about the state of the economy that he's been doing a little research on. And I think he'd really be pertinent for him to share this information with us.
Yeah, these are things I heard on the radio this week, and I kind of jotted them down. 1.6 million bankruptcies filed. House index is at 16, and it's got to get over 50 to be healthy. Households lost $1.8 trillion of wealth in this last stock market crash or recession thing. The blacks are leaving the inner city to go to the segregated South for jobs, and you bet they're less paid. 44 million extreme poverty now because of the food and energy prices. The gas went up in 1 month 7%, food up 3%, and pharmaceuticals 2% up. Maybe we need to be at the bargaining table per month.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Affordable cars are the worst since the late 60s. 68, the wages were the best buying power to buy a house and a car. They ought to go back to the common sense of that time. And here's some of the idiot moron stuff. You can't cut the Pentagon spending because of security.
Whose security?
Look at all that money the security has cost this country. That's the people's jobs.
Yes, indeed. And they call security, I mean, these corporate wars of aggression, Iraq and Afghanistan, and I mean, those are being fought for the oil companies and the other corporate interests.
And don't forget, we need stability, too.
Good point. Okay, John.
Okay. The highest civilian Medal of Freedom to George W. Bush and Buffett.
Now, by Obama, Barack Obama.
I want to state, after Buckminster Fuller's death, Senior Bush was in there and the activists pushed him to give him the highest civilian medal.
But they had to push him to do it.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
After his death.
And then I see Obama on television glorifying the centennial birthday of Ronald Reagan. And how is, I mean, this is disgusting. I mean, in addition to the stuff that he's doing to hurt working people. And, you know, these people voted for him, I mean, in vast, large percentages.
And Illinois politicians get a raise after the 66 2/3 percent tax increase on new people. And then the bargaining rights of Wisconsin. They need to point out to these people that that's federal law. You have the right to your bargaining rights. Mm-hmm. Why are they violating it? Why aren't labor laws taught to the people in the schools?
And labor history, indeed.
Yeah,
and the fact there's a statute in the book in Illinois that's not enforced.
Yeah. These laws, and senators like Angel of Nevada wants to get rid of unemployment, Social Security. Those were created in the great after the Great Depression in the labor laws for the economy to get better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, see, there's something that a lot of people don't really realize about a lot of, quote, entitlements or, quote, welfare or whatever, or other benefits by that workers and others get. For example, workers' compensation, there's been much talk about how Wisconsin has really high workers' compensation rates, and also there's talk about that here in Illinois at the same time. Well, they don't realize that. The history of workers' compensation is that the employers wanted workers' compensation laws because before workers' compensation insurance, the only way these things were settled was through lawsuits. And while those lawsuits were going on, the worker basically starved, and the employers were getting tired of the lawsuits.
Who owns the unemployment insurance is what it's called. Who owns that insurance company?
Well, now there is a difference there. The workers' compensation are private insurance companies. I remember one time my dad, he had a very small trucking company, about four trucks. He had one of his drivers, I think, jumped out of the truck or something and broke his leg, and the workers' compensation insurance was fighting the payoff. My dad called them up and bitched them out big time, saying, "What am I paying you premiums for? You're supposed to take care of my person." But unemployment insurance is administered by the states and the federal government. And but you got to remember that all of these things are supposed to be buffers built into the system to prevent violent swings and help provide some stability and equilibrium and help prevent huge cascading losses in the economy that lead to things like the Great Depression.
Right, and actually on that note too, and Bill is right in looking at this historically, that also so much of this was people wanting their hands on the money that working people were starting to and had to invest because of the lack of any sort of federal or state statutes for workers' compensation. They did them through their unions, what amounts were available through private health, death, and injury insurance, and also did them through various, especially in urban areas like Chicago, ethnic institutions, which, when the Depression came along, all failed.
Mm-hmm.
They failed and went bankrupt, and you saw the societal poverty and the inability of these smaller local institutions to meet this demand, and we're in a depression-like moment. So that was why, in so many ways, these ended up coming about at the time, is what local and ad hoc institutions had failed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I got a little paper over here. This is from an Alternet article. Alternet's a really good website. Has a lot of really good. It's a news aggregation website, and this is from one called "Nine Pictures That Expose This Country's Obscene Division of Wealth" by Dave Johnson, not the one here, but someone who has a blog for Our Future. Anyway, in one paragraph, he says, "How much is a billion?" Well, some Wall Street types and others make over $1 billion a year each year. How much is $1 billion? How can you visualize an amount of money so high? Well, here's one way to think about it. The median household income in the U.S. is around $29,000, which is a shame in itself, meaning half of us make less and half more. If you make $29,000 a year and don't spend a single penny of it, it will take you 34,482 years to save $1 billion.
34,000
years.
Wow, that's quite a interesting statistic there. Okay, we're going to be having some callers call in live from Madison, Wisconsin here in the second half of the program. So at this point, I think probably what we want to do is go to Tom Thomas's poem of the week, which is "Close the Plantations Down."
Labor can build America to the dream that was meant to be, if workers bring the plantations down and make us the land of the free. Labor has built the structures that have stood since our nation was born. Workers have cried and bled and died to bring us a bright shining morn. 'Twas labor that built the highways that brought us together as one. From coast to coast and north to south, what magnificent jobs they've done. Yet laborers are victims now of the big brothers straight from hell, violated and spied upon, even in our homes where we dwell. Some sneaky snakes in Washington connive to bring slavery back, with benefits and wages cut, the deck against labor is stacked. 'Twas labor built the buildings where the most evil rulers now rule, the ones who stole their offices but never have handled a tool. In this 21st century, this time of the neocon lie, it's time to stand up against them and show them that labor won't die. It's time for unions to be strong to protect this land that they built. Gene Debs, Joe Hill, or Mother Jones would not let our liberties wilt. Laborers gather together and stand up against them as one. Show each Judas in Washington our unions will never be done. Close the Plantations Down was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on January 17, 2006. And you heard it live today, February 19, 2011, here on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Excellent poem this week, Tom. Very, very timely, very excellent.
Yeah, good stuff, Tom.
Got one public service announcement here. Educating in Capitalist America, Resisting the Industrial Model. In Standardized Education Effective, what do we do? What does it serve? There's a presentation on Saturday, February 26th, from 3 to 5 at the Coffee House in downtown Bloomington. Let's see who we've got here on the line. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, David.
Yes.
This is Jermaine at the Capitol. I mean, Madison.
In Madison, Wisconsin. Jermaine, thanks for calling in. Well, tell us what's going on up there.
Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. We hear all the people chanting in the background, too.
I can barely hear what you're saying. I'm going to back off just a little bit so I can converse with you. So I'm in the middle of the rotunda of the Madison State Capitol, and there is a tremendous rally in here. People on all levels, looking down, we're at the bottom. It's really fantastic.
Okay, Jermaine, you say there's lots of people there and everything. Have you seen any of these counter demonstrators yet?
David, I can hear your voice, but I can't hear what you're saying yet. So I'm still walking away from the rotunda because it's just too deafening in there for me to be able to really talk with you. So I'm going to try going back to your elevator bathroom so I can see if we can hear each other.
Hello, this is Bill Grell. I'm not talking to you right now, Jermaine. I'm just putting in a little comment while you're getting to a quieter area. But I do remember 1996 when 15,000 people showed up at the Illinois State House in Springfield, Illinois, when the Republicans took over and were threatening various cutbacks and so on and so forth. And we took over the rotunda. And it was a very exciting time, and it was just amazing seeing all of those people. So I can just imagine what it's like in Wisconsin, in Madison, Wisconsin right now. Anyway, Jermaine, can you hear us any better now?
Yeah, I'm afraid we lost her here.
Yeah, sounds like.
But anyway, I'm sure she'll call back here. And everything, and I just got a note here from Bill Gorell that there's supposed to be a picket, SEIU picket, union picket on Wednesday, February 23rd on the U of I campus. And I would just want to say that we want to let our listeners know about this, but also if you want more information on this, you can call 328-2295. That's 328-2295. Okay, we're hoping that Jermaine will be calling us back here real soon to give us some more updates. We're also expecting another caller to call us in as well, who was at the Capitol yesterday in Madison, Wisconsin, and describe the events there. But just from the sounds that we were hearing there, it sounded like there was a lot of people. I mean,
it sounds like the place is packed.
Here we go again. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, David. I thought I'd try again a little further away.
Oh, you sound a lot. I can hear you a little bit better now. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear what you're saying now. Okay. And I'm where I am right now. This is Jermaine Light, and I'm in part of a rally here at the Wisconsin State Capitol in Madison, Wisconsin. And it's very, very exciting. There's two rallies, at least, one outside the Capitol building and one in simultaneously, and huge crowds. I couldn't even begin to tell you how many people here. One really cool thing that happened right as we walked into the Capitol building was that just about 30 minutes ago was that the Firefighters Union made an appearance and walked through the rally, and everybody was just outside it, you know, just really, really happy and lots of cheering, and the firefighters are with us. And then the Policemen's Union came through, had a representative envoy walk through the middle of the rally, and it was just, you should have heard this cheering. I mean, it was really cool because those two unions evidently would not have been included in the bill. In other words, they wouldn't have been hurt. Their pensions wouldn't have been hurt, or I'm sorry, their collective bargaining rights wouldn't have been hurt. But they are on our side, and that, I think, is wonderful solidarity. Are you still there?
Hi, Jermaine. This is Jason. I'm a co-host. Dave had asked earlier, and it's worth asking, too, since especially the Tea Partiers are planning a counter-rally, do you happen to know whether or not that they have shown up yet? And if so, or whether or not that occurs, have you heard anything about plans to counter-demonstrate outside as well?
Yes, I have heard plans I am aware that it's possible that Tea Partiers are here. I haven't actually firsthand seen them. When we got on the bus at the AFSCME, Wisconsin Education Association headquarters, on the edge of the town, and we got on a bus shuttle to come here, the volunteer who was a Wisconsin teacher told us there might be such a rally, and to make sure that we stay peaceful, and if we are provoked, to try to keep from retaliating.
Hi, Jermaine. This is Bill Grell, and I'm glad I'm not there because I would be too easily provoked. But, I mean, actually, I had a run-in at the original Tea Party here in Champaign back in April 15th, 2009, and it was just awful. These people, they will be terrible if they get there. But I want to ask you something as a laborer. I was wondering, are there many building trades union members there?
Oh, yes, and in fact, building trades, we're giving away cooked, freshly grilled bratwurst, excuse me, sir, and on the right before we got to the outside rally, they're handing out nice, hot bratwurst, which is great in this cool 30-degree weather here. And, really, really nice of them to do that.
Well, that's excellent to hear. I mean, this is really inspiring to hear that unions that aren't going to be affected by this from the private sector, from the building trades in particular, and especially the firefighters. And God, I never thought I'd ever, experience the day. But top marks for the policemen's union there for coming
absolutely.
Out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're so happy with the police and the firefighters. In fact, there's some policemen standing right next to me right here. And I want to thank these policemen also for standing with us. And this one right next to me has a big smile on his face. Thank you, sir. I'm reporting back to Champaign-Urbana that the policemen are with us and the firefighters as well.
Yes,
so we're really happy about that.
Tell them we're broadcasting live over the Internet.
Yes, we're being broadcast live over the Internet right now on a radio show in Champaign-Urbana, the Labor Hour. So at any rate, yes, there's a lot of solidarity here. I mean, this is a union dream up here. I mean, this is great. And what we came up here with a group of graduate employee organization GEO members.
Yes.
And we had several cars and we got separated. We didn't really try to stay together because we all had directions and arrived at different times, and we haven't really met up with them yet. They're here somewhere. But we immediately ran into some other IEA staff people and Illinois Education Association, my union, and that was kind of cool. But we left them to come into the Capitol to see what was going on in here. And beautiful Capitol building, by the way. I'd never been inside. Gorgeous, on par with the Illinois State Capitol as far as beauty. But, wow, I tell you what, it's just really cool up here. I'm so glad we came. And everybody's so happy when they find out that we're from Champaign-Urbana. They're just jumping up and down. Why, you came all the way here? And I'm sure there's quite a few people from Illinois here.
Yeah, Jermaine, speaking of the Illinois State House, I was wondering if the Wisconsin State House, similar to the Illinois State House, has a series of paintings up close to the rotunda on the ceiling of working people back in the 19th century, which I find very interesting. And it shows you the different cultures at different times when these buildings were built, where they would have it illustrated like that. Is they have the same sort of thing at the Wisconsin State House?
Well, you know, I haven't explored the artwork a whole lot. I do love art, and I immediately noticed the ones immediately up above on the tundra ceiling and so forth, the rotunda ceiling. And, you know, but a lot of it looked to me, I didn't look at it real carefully, it looked more like, I'm not sure, maybe biblical or mythological
fitting
characters. I'm not sure, I didn't quite catch it. But very pretty.
Uh-huh.
Very beautiful. There might be some worker stuff around. I'll have to take a better look at it.
Well, if it's biblical, then let's just now declare a biblical curse of pestilence on Governor Walker and his other anti-union, anti-working people legislation. But you know, Jermaine, sometimes it takes a crisis like this to really get working people mobilized. And you know, there's always a silver lining in every cloud. And I think this is probably maybe one of the best things. This might be one of the best things that could have happened to organized labor in years. And who knows? We might be thanking Governor Walker here in the future for basically giving us all a wake up call and helping us get up. Off our feet and getting moving here and everything. Jermaine, I want to thank you very much for calling in and giving us that live report. And, you know, after you get back, maybe we can get you on the air and you could go in a little more detail about some things that happened up there today.
Absolutely. And I'll take some more pictures of the inside of the Capitol and see what other stories I can bring back.
Okay, Jason Kozlowski would like one last question for you.
Yeah, actually, I had just one last comment was I also belong to GEO 6300, so send all my regards to everyone there who could be there when I couldn't. And one of the things, too, if you could give us some feedback when you come back about how long, I know you're going to be up there for the day and some others are, let us know how long people plan to be there who are occupying it, if this is going to be as long-term as we hope it is until this plays out.
Yes, what I do know now is that there's supposed to be another rally at 4:30. And a lot of people said that they were, some people on the bus with us said that they were here yesterday until about 10:30 at night. So, you know, I guess it just goes on and on.
Yeah, I think that's what this takes, really. This should go on as long as it takes, up to and including after these draconian laws might pass.
That's right. That's right. So, and you know, I also want to applaud the Democratic senators who left and are making just as big a statement as we are, too. That took some guts to do that.
Yes,
I know they've been under a lot of criticism, so I want to say I think they did the right thing. This is too extreme. This is eroding our rights. This is unconstitutional to try to pass this bill.
Well, if they're not playing by the rules, why should we? I mean, this is all-out class war, so, we got to do what we have to do to protect the basic rights and standards of living and working people. So, Jermaine, thanks again so much for calling in and giving us that live report.
Hey, power to the people!
Amen.
Power to the people!
We're proud of you.
Okay.
Solidarity! Thank you.
Take care. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Here we go. For the fight all the workers who are twisted, tricked, and robbed. To the peasant in Guatemala in a sweatshop got your job. And she can't feed her family on the pennies that she makes. Meanwhile, the crime rate's rising up and down the Great Lakes states. Vegetables left in the field, the signatures smell rotten, and the contracts and the deeds that push the race down to the bottom. They load the rubber bullets, they fire another round. I'm heading to the tear gas, dig in man, hold your ground. For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. For our brothers and our sisters up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. For the union men and women standing up and standing strong. Help! That's right.
si nos queremos juntos vamos a ganar. Si, y'all hit them where it hurts and bite the hand that feeds. You might get 1 to 3 or probation and a fine. Well, I know where I'm gonna be. I'm gonna be right on that front line for Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time for our brothers and our sisters up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long, for the Union men and women standing up and standing strong. Yep.
Okay, that was Tom Morello from his Night Watchman CD, One Man Revolution, and the name of the song was Union Song. And we just felt that was very appropriate considering that very inspiring live update from Jermaine Light, who's a union school teacher who teaches in Mahomet, Illinois. And we, of course, are in February in Black History Month, and I wanted to just do a short segment on that, and then we're going to be going into just a general discussion here about these interesting times and events that we're living in here. Today, we're going to do a segment on A. Philip Randolph. A. Philip Randolph was born April 15th, 1889 in Crescent City, Florida. After graduating high school, Randolph worked odd jobs and devoted his time to singing and acting and reading W.E.B. Du Bois, The Souls of Black Folk, convinced him that the fight for social equality was most important and that he needed to dedicate his life to that. At the age of 21 in 1910, Randolph joined the Socialist Party of America in response to increasing segregation and discrimination against African Americans. Randolph shunned moderate reform and racial integration as advocated by W.E.B. Du Bois. Instead, he emphasized socialism and unionism. In 1917, Randolph and Chandler Owen founded the Messenger newspaper with the help of the Socialist Party of America. It was a radical monthly publication which campaigned against lynching, opposed U.S. participation in World War I, urged African Americans to resist being drafted, to fight for an integrated society, and recommend they join radical unions like the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW. As a result of this, both A. Philip Randolph and Chandler Owen were brought up on charges of the Sedition Act. Basically, it's a hair's breadth away from being charged with treason. And they went to trial and everything, and they were found not guilty. Randolph later ran on the socialist ticket for New York Comptroller in 1920 and for Secretary of State of New York in 1922. As he later became a union organizer, Randolph had some experience in this, organizing the elevator operators in New York City in 1917. 1919, he became president of the National Brotherhood of Workers of America, a union which organized amongst African-American shipyard and dock workers in the Tidewater region of Virginia. The union dissolved in 1921 under pressure from the American Federation of Labor. In 1925, Randolph organized the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and was elected president. And this was the first serious effort to form a labor institution for employees of the Pullman Company, which was a major employer of African Americans. The railroads had expanded dramatically in the early 20th century, and jobs offered relatively good employment at a time of widespread racial discrimination. Want to add that Pullman, the sleeping car Pullman Company, had its own company union, if you will, and Randolph basically organized around this union to form a real union for the workers. With amendments of the Railroad Labor Act in 1934, sleeping car porters were eventually granted rights under federal law. Membership in the Brotherhood jumped to more than 7,000 after years of bitter struggle with the Pullman Company. Finally began to negotiate with the Brotherhood in 1935 and agreed to a contract with them in 1937. This gained employees over $2 million in pay increases, a shorter work week, and overtime pay. In addition to this, Randolph emerged as one of the most visible spokesmen for African-American civil rights. In 1941, he and Bayard Rustin and A.J. Musty proposed a march on Washington to protest racial discrimination in war industries and proposed the desegregation of the American armed forces. The march was canceled after President of the United States Franklin Roosevelt issued Executive Order 8802 of the Fair Employment Act. In 1947, Randolph with colleague Grant Reynolds renewed efforts to end discrimination in armed forces, forming a committee against Jim Crow in the military service, and was successful that when on July 26, 1948, President Harry Truman abolished racial segregation in the armed forces through Executive Order 9881. Randolph organized a march on Washington for jobs and freedom with the help of Bayard Rustin and Martin Luther King, and the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is attributed in part to the success of this march on Washington, where black and white Americans stood united and witnessed King's I Have a Dream speech. As the U.S. civil rights movement gained momentum in the early 1960s and came to the forefront of the nation's consciousness, Randolph was often heard on television news programs addressing the nation on behalf of African Americans engaged in the struggle for voting rights and an end to discrimination in public accommodations. He was also an active participant in many other organization causes, including the Working Men's Circle. And I want to also add to this that the sleeping car porters during the civil rights struggle were very active participants in using their back and forth across the South in the trains, delivering messages and various civil rights newspapers to all these small towns all across the South.
That's right.
It reminds me of the brakeman on the car that kept falling off the railroad car, and Westinghouse said we could put brakes on them. Well, the railroad didn't want any of that part of that for the cost. They said those people were expendable.
That's right, man. People are renters or rentals. You know, you that's how you treat rentals. And another thing, too, you may check Netflix and see if you can find a film called, I believe it's 10,000 Men Named George. Which
it's 10,000 Black Men Named George, yes.
Black Men.
Exactly.
Yes, which was a
DVD.
For some reason, Showtime really got into it. They also did Harlan County War back a few years ago, too. And also on archive.org, there is a really terrible quality recording of A. Philip Randolph confronting FDR on the subject of discrimination in the defense industries, but it's too difficult for us to play here. Something that I would like to do real quickly right now, I don't know if you've heard about this, but this is a goodbye letter, we can say, from a man named Mark, who's a 99er, who has decided, as he said, to euthanize himself.
Bill, what is a 99er for those listeners that don't know what you're referring to?
Well, even with the unlike in Europe, where they have unlimited, I believe, unemployment, and also you get higher payments, in the United States, even with the extensions due to this tremendous, what I'm calling now the decession, people, you only get 99 weeks of unemployment, and many people have run out. I mean, I can't remember how many million it is now. And this is a letter supposedly from a man named Mark. And he has decided that he just can't go on anymore. He's a 60-year-old ex-middle management college-educated person. Okay, and this is to the unemployed, the sick, the disabled, and poor. Hello. I'm unemployed over 2 years now, a 99er without any benefits for 3 months. I followed Unemployed Friends almost from its start, never posted until now, but I'm grateful for my time with you all. I did his ass with calls and emails, etc. I have a confession to make to you all. I'm a criminal. I've obeyed the Ten Commandments and all laws except I'm unemployed, and that's now a crime. I'm poor, and that's a crime. I'm worthless surplus population, and that's a crime. I'm a Main Street American citizen born and raised in the USA, and now that's a crime. And I'm euthanizing myself as I write this note. So arrest my corpse. This isn't a call for help. The deed is done. It's not what I wanted. Death is my best available option. It's not just that my bank account is $4, that I've not eaten in a week. Not because hunger pangs are agonizing. Not because I live in physical and mental anguish. Not because the landlady is banging on the door nonstop and I face eviction. Not that Congress and the President have sent a strong message they no longer help the unemployed. It's because I'm a law-abiding, the worthless, long-term unemployed older man who is surplus population. Had I used my college education to rip people off and steal from the elderly, poor,
disabled, and Main Street Americans, I would be wearing different shoes now. A petty king. Hard work, honesty, loving kindness, charity and mercy, and becoming unemployed and destitute, unable to pay your bills, are all considered foolishness and high crimes in America now. Whereas stealing and lying and cheating and being greedy to excess and destroying the fabric of America is rewarded and protected, even making such people petty kings and petty queens among us. Then he goes on with a paragraph with a lot of horrendous statistics about our economics. It says that 12 years ago he lost his family. 10 years ago he lost the love of his life and couldn't visit him in the hospital because they as a gay couple had no rights. 7 years ago, I was diagnosed with diabetes and stage 2 high blood pressure with various complications, including kidney problems, mild heart failure, diabetic retinopathy. These conditions are debilitating and painful. I am on over 8 prescribed medications, which is difficult without insurance and income. But I struggled on, and my primary caregiver was very pleased with my effort over time. Still, these physical disabilities have progressively worsened, and I have had a harder and harder time functioning in basic ways. All the while, I give thanks to God because I know there are many more worse off than me. And I tried to help by giving money to charities and smiling at people who looked down and sharing what little I had. I'm college educated and worked 35 years in management, receiving written references and praise from every boss for whom I worked. Yet after thousands of resumes, applications, emails, phone calls, and drop-ins, I failed to get a job even at McDonald's. I've discovered there are 3 strikes against me. Most 99ers will understand. Strike 1. Businesses are not hiring long-term unemployed. In fact, many job ads now underline the unemployed need not apply. Strike 2. I am almost 60 years old. Employers prefer hiring younger workers who demand less and are better pack mules. Strike 3. For every job opening I've applied, there are over 300 applicants according to each business who allowed a follow-up call. With the U3 unemployment, that's the usual thing you hear, folks, holding steady at 9.6% and the U6, which is closer to the actual unemployment, at 17% for the past 18 months, the chances of me or any 99er landing a job is less than winning the Mega Million jackpot. On top of that, even the most conservative economists admit unemployment will not start to fall before 2012. Well, folks, there's more here, but I don't want to take up too much time. And I want you to know, too, I think that we're at a tipping point, and I think that Wisconsin, Madison, is showing that we are at a tipping point. And the people in Madison, they're just not fighting for their own jobs as public employees. The people in the building trades have to realize that after they've come for the public employees, and after they take care of the public employees, they will come for us. You will hear Bill O'Reilly, Rush Limbaugh, Glenn Beck, and so on and so on and so on, saying there, that person holding that sign on that road is costing us $60 an hour. It's costing you that, taxpayer. And after they get rid of the building trades, there's not going to be much union left. There's not going to be much left for anybody to have even sympathy with people like Mark and other 99ers, much less try and do anything to improve things in this country. So keep that in mind. Keep that in mind every time you hear of Rush Limbaugh calling, get this, he was actually calling the people in Madison freeloaders and bottom feeders.
Yeah.
Well, he's one of the worst bottom feeders of all.
Yeah. Well, absolutely siphoning and shilling for corporate America for his bloated salaries. While these people in Wisconsin, and there's a good statistic here, a couple good statistics I want to share. You know, that they're blamed for this budgetary crisis, and yet Steve Greenhouse, in an article today in the New York Times, showed that people with bachelor's degrees who work for the state in Wisconsin make about $6,000 a year less than people with bachelor's degrees who work in the private sector. So the idea that in Wisconsin, what Governor Walker is talking about bringing state workers into line, who, by the way, these state workers who are unionized may often make less than $30,000 a year working in cafeterias and cleaning floors and emptying waste baskets and other things. But the idea that somehow these people need to be brought in line with people in the private sector, flies in the face of the reality for an awful lot of people who are skilled and educated in other things. And this is a manufactured crisis. And Bill's exactly right in calling this a tipping point. This is the Taft-Hartley moment of this generation. Like what went on in 46 and 47 against the fight against these sorts of laws, which, ironically enough, were looking to impose right-to-work status on workers in various places and did so through a whole host of provisions. That's what is trying to go on here, what they want to do in Wisconsin, Indiana, Ohio, and Tennessee, where these fights are also occurring. This is a ginned-up crisis where in Wisconsin you have about $140 million that was recently passed for various provisions, as Brian Buettler talked about in Talking Points memo. For one, $25 million for an economic development fund for job creation, this fund of which still has $73 million in it because of the anemic economy. Two, $48 million for private health savings accounts, which happens to be a GOP bailiwick. And three, $67 million for tax incentives for private employers, which hasn't spurred any hiring there. As they're talking about $137 million budgetary shortfall for this coming year, there's your budget shortfall. Right there. And yet the public sector is supposed to be blamed for this and looking at long-term having their rights rolled back in addition to salaries and everything else on every front. It's a war on everyday people based on unvarnished nonsense.
Yes, indeed. And the fact is this is the agenda of the majority of the Republicans, and unfortunately, I'm sorry to say, the majority of the Democrats who are corporate Democrats, I don't want to say all Democrats, but those who are corporate Democrats want to basically push our wages and living standards down to third world levels for the purpose of cheap labor, in order for their corporate buddies to make even more billions of dollars on top of the obscene wealth they already have. This is the agenda. This is what we must fight. And the thing is whether or not you're in a union or even whether or not you're a worker or a small business owner, the thing is that this is going to hurt everybody, because the less money people have in their pockets to spend, basically anything to spend above food and shelter, is going to hurt the economy even more. It's a downward spiral. And, I mean, these people are going to basically just push this economy down even farther with these policies. But the important thing is the class war has begun a long time ago, but now a lot of working people are finally waking up to the fact that, yes, the class war is here, and, yes, these people have no sense of justice and no sense of even reason. They are out for pushing us down to poverty level, to subsistence level, and we must fight back. Everybody must fight back.
This goes out to Liz. I got your message. The poem was by our poet in residence, Tom Thomas, and I'll make sure I get a copy of it and put it up on Facebook for you.
Okay, I was going to say, John, you want some
words
for our listeners?
I was wondering where the five heads of the National Labor Relations Board stand on this.
Well, I don't know, but it's been awful quiet out of Washington. All Barack Obama can see to say is that he's concerned and watching the situation. Well, you know, as you pointed out earlier, John, I mean, if there's any justification for federal intervention, I mean, this should be it, because as you mentioned earlier, this is what he's trying to do is a violation of federal labor laws and stuff. And, you know, this shouldn't be allowed. I mean, you think about all the volunteer time and the $140 million that organized labor gave to Barack Obama. Not only would he not do anything to pass the Employee Free Choice Act, which would give people more rights to organize in the private sector, I mean, he won't even get involved in this.
Yeah, it's just a lot of words before John's got something to say here. That it's just an awful lot of words. And also, you know, with this in particular, too, Obama is getting grief for his, what is his organization that's allegedly being, you know, that's been organizing some of this, these protests, when all of this notice is behind the scenes, that all of this where labor leaders are coming in and Trumka and others are coming in to this belatedly is late. That where is all of this ahead of time in terms of anticipating these sorts of movements and doing something about all this and being out in front of all this when they had the opportunity? That Obama's strongest words, and these have only been words so far, came at a point when they're more politically hamstrung than they were 2 years ago, when they had an opportunity to do something about the Employee Free Choice Act, that when they have a chance to do something about it, they don't, and then they become strident when they know that something like this would never end up passing the House anyway.
Yes, indeed. And